You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
By the end of a momentous week, just 1 year ago, Bank of America had bought Merrill Lynch in a shotgun wedding, Lehman Brothers had filed for bankruptcy, the Federal Reserve had agreed to lend AIG $85 billion, and credit was effectively frozen, all in the span of that 1 week. We have frequently spoken about the financial meltdown throughout this year with William D. Cohn, author of the bestseller House of Cards, and I'm pleased to welcome him back to our show today. Hello.
Thank you, Leonard.
Did things get as bad as we thought they would at the end of this week last year?
Actually, I think they got worse in subsequent weeks after the Paulson, famously Henry Paulson, the former Treasury Secretary, famously put forth that three-page proposal for what became TARP 1, and then the Congress voted it down. And that's when really the markets froze up and the real panic spread, I think.
Well, just this past Tuesday, Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke said, from a technical perspective, the recession is very likely over at this point. Now, I looked at that and I thought, what does a technical perspective mean?
Well, I mean, if you go back to what Bernanke said this summer in Jackson Hole, Wyoming, where he spoke about the crisis being an acute loss of investor confidence, and by the way, I think he was absolutely right. I mean, that does sum it up in a nutshell. I think from that perspective, you know, we've pulled back from that brink. A lot of confidence has been restored to the market. Not to say there aren't a lot of areas of weakness still out there. Unemployment, commercial real estate, leveraged buyout loans. But, you know, the Dow has gone from 6,500 to 9,800. People are starting to feel pretty good again.
But that loss of investor confidence was a reasonable thing, wasn't it? Are people becoming too optimistic too quickly?
I mean, there was a lot to be pessimistic about.
You just mentioned a jobless recovery.
Right. Job creation is a lagging indicator. It takes time for people to feel. I mean, one of the problems still is that smaller businesses cannot get access to credit and capital, and they're the ones that create so many of the jobs in this country, and that's just not happening yet.
And yesterday there was news that New York City's unemployment rate has now reached 10.3%. That's I don't know when the last time we were that low. So we have the Dow reaching a new high for the year. And I don't understand these contradictory economic news stories.
Well, again, it is troubling, and we go through these cycles that seem to be happening faster and faster, where people evidence, they don't want to be cut out of the momentum of the stock market, and, you know, it may not be as good as people think. And that's why other people are calling for a new technical correction in the market. And so it's a very scary time still, despite what, the market would tell you and that some investors would want us to believe.
When the crisis was at its peak around this time last year, the Treasury and the Fed tried a series of ad hoc responses, from saving companies to forcing them to merge or just letting them fail. So do we know by now if one approach has worked better than the others? Or was this mix of approaches the best way to go about it?
Well, I've given a lot of thought to that, Leonard, obviously. And I'm not sure completely in my mind, and I think about it continuously, and it changes. I actually think the mix of what they did actually was effective, because Bernanke had been a leading authority on the Great Depression as an economist, and he knew well the dangers of doing too little. So he was a proponent of doing perhaps too much, and I think that it was not only important to save Bear Stearns, or really the creditors of Bear Stearns, it may turn out to have been, as Joe Nocera wrote in the Times last Saturday, I believe, important to let Lehman Brothers fail so that the regulations and the laws could be changed, because I don't think the political will would have been there otherwise. I'm sad to say that, but I think it may in fact be political reality.
But it's odd, because this happened during the Bush administration, which was a firm believer in Friedmanism, and suddenly we're doing a Keynesian response, aren't we?
Well, the turned out that the realities were such that they had to, you know, and I think it was Bernanke, really, who had a firm view on this, that they weren't going to allow, doing nothing was not an option. This was the equivalent of war, wartime, and they threw everything at it. As I think, you know, we're, at the moment, it feels like that's the right thing. It may be too early to tell.
Well, what Joe Nocera, as you said that Lehman Brothers had to die so other financial institutions could live. But a lot has been made about the whole business of Lehman Brothers' failure and the idea that we had to inject moral hazard into this equation. Has moral hazard really had much of an impact? You're making a face.
Yeah, right. I'm making a face because I think it was Larry Summers, actually, who early on in the 90s or 80s or something talked about moral hazard, and you know, now it's become this weird government buzzword. I think it's you know, the fact of the matter, they tried one thing that saved Bear Stearns. They thought that might improve the markets by Labor Day of last year when Fannie and Freddie failed, and then it was clear that Lehman was going to fail. Things, they had to throw the playbook out, and so you know, call it Keynesian, call it Friedman-esque. You know, they had to do what they had to do.
Conspiracy theorists wonder whether Henry Paulson's relationship with Goldman Sachs played a role in deciding which investment banks got support from the Treasury Department and which ones didn't.
Yeah, and I think,
or was it Lehman? Lehman was the weakest one and the most leveraged, and it was the obvious one to let fail.
Well, no. First of all, I think that conspiracy theorists make a lot of the relationship between the government and Goldman Sachs, both, you know, starting with Bob Rubin, who, of course, had been a former CEO of Goldman, and then with Paulson.
And there are others as well.
Oh, and then Paulson brought around him a cadre of Goldman bankers, which was quite astounding, actually. I think death order, if you will, is important here. I mean, had Lehman been the one to fail in March, I suspect that the government would have forced J.P. Morgan to buy Lehman, just like they forced them to buy Bear, and they would have provided the assistance to do that. I think, 6 months later, it turns out that Bank of America, who they thought might buy Lehman, was interested in buying Merrill, as we now know. And, you know, Barclays, for whatever reason, you know, some say it was they never intended to, others say it was the UK regulators wouldn't allow them to buy it. And so the argument that is put forth by Paulson and Bernanke is that there was no buyer there. Unfortunately, that may be true, but they could have injected capital and they chose not to.
And there are people still wondering why Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch, considering what a debacle it's turned out to be.
Yes,
they were so hot to buy a company that was in so much trouble.
Well, that goes back to a year earlier when Ken Lewis wanted to buy Merrill in September of 2007, and the lead independent director at Merrill at that time basically nixed that deal. So he'd always been quite interested in Merrill for his strategic reasons, and it may yet prove to be a very good strategic deal. Unfortunately, it's cost us $40 billion and counting at the moment.
My guest is William D. Cohen, author of the bestseller House of Cards, which laid out what happened just a year ago this week. A lot has happened in this year. At least it hasn't turned out to be people selling apples and pencils on the street, although we have heard some pretty terrible stories. Are banks continuing to use high levels of leverage? Because the Times has been publishing some stories that suggest that they're just finding new ways of doing the same old thing.
Well, they're using a lot less leverage now than they were. And well, let's be clear. I mean, we've lost three of the top five securities firms, and the other two have become bank holding companies. So basically, Wall Street as it used to exist no longer exists, and the Wall Street that used to exist used 30, 40, 50 times leverage to do business.
But it's been reported that Goldman Sachs has increased its degree of leverage since the start of the financial crisis.
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I understand that because they're now more closely regulated by the Fed. They're mm-hmm. regulated like a bank, and banks can only have, 10 to 15 times leverage, and I'm sure that's what Goldman Sachs has.
Although we've been focusing on the events of this week 1 year ago, hadn't there been warning signs throughout the economy for months before? Wasn't the fire sale of Bear Stearns to J.P. Morgan Chase in March of 2008 a major indication? So why were government regulators taken by surprise in September?
I don't think they were taken by surprise, actually. And I mean, when I spent a lot of time with Tim Geithner, who was then the head of the New York Fed for my book, and he was very clear to me that he saw warning signs along the way.
But they didn't seem to be doing anything.
Well, he was doing what he felt he could do. I mean, the real question for all the regulators is why not? They always struggle with whether to, you know, pop the balloon, so to speak, how to take the air out of the balloon, and they didn't do it.
Well, we'd already seen the federal takeover of Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae the week before. The problems with Lehman and Merrill Lynch hit the fan. So I'm assuming that the government already knew that mortgage-backed assets serious problem.
Oh, well, they knew that in the spring of 2007.
Okay. But they weren't doing anything.
That's right. They weren't doing anything.
Was this because of ideology in the Bush administration or just because it was impossible to do anything under the circumstances of the time?
I think there's a little of both, Leonard, actually. I think, first of all, Tim Geithner, head of the New York Fed, he said that, you know, that wasn't my – I was not the regulator of Wall Street. That responsibility belonged to Christopher Cox at the SEC. And he was probably ill-equipped for the job, and he did not, you know, in keeping with the laissez-faire policies of the Bush administration, did not want to intrude too quickly. They had agreed in June of 2004, when they allowed Wall Street investment banks to increase their leverage, that the quid pro quo for that was that they were going to be much more involved with the regulation on a daily basis of the Wall Street firms. But they forgot to do that.
They forgot to do that.
Or they didn't do it.
The argument has been made that we had to bail out these institutions because they were too big to fail. But in several cases, as you have pointed out, the shotgun weddings of Merrill Lynch to Bank of America and Bear Stearns to J.P. Morgan Chase, we've created even bigger banks. Now they're really too big to fail.
That's absolutely right. And
so why hasn't there been a push to break them up? I mean, there's a push every so often to break up the Yankees whenever they get too big.
Because it's very difficult to break up these banks, especially after you force them together. In effect, Lehman was broken up completely. I mean, it's all been spread out into its component parts and reformed through other owners. So sometimes the market forces it, but when government steps in, the tendency is, unfortunately, to make it bigger. I mean, you know, once upon a time we had an antitrust division at the Justice Department in this country. I don't know where it's been the last 10 or 15, 20 years. But once upon a time, the Justice Department would force a breakup. Maybe that's what's needed. And in fact, you know, a little bit of that is going on with Citigroup because they are breaking themselves up.
And we should point out that the whole antitrust thing did not begin with the Bush administration or even, I guess it goes back to the Reagan administration, then through the Clinton administration as well.
Yes, I mean, there was, you know, Wall Street continues to have a lot of power in Washington despite all of this and before all of this, and Wall Street likes mergers.
So what happens if one of these mega banks fails? Is that even possible? Are we going to have, do you think that we could have, see more bailouts somewhere down the line?
Well, I think, and Niall Ferguson, the writer and Harvard professor, has been outspoken on this lately, and I think we've created, you know, at least, you know, five or six or seven large banks that are not going to be allowed to fail at this point. But ironically, at the same time that we've done that, there's at least 400 smaller regional banks on the FDIC watch list, which means that they are probably in trouble of failing. And we've had more bank failures this year than we've had since the savings and loan crisis in the 80s. I mean, it's almost at 100 so far. And there's a huge problem in commercial real estate mortgages. So as we've created these seven or eight banks that are too big to fail, and I think they are legitimately now too big to fail, and they're too systemic, and that's a problem, there's, you know, 400 others that are, you know, on death's door.
My guest is William D. Cohn, author of the bestseller House of Cards. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. We're back with William D. Cohn, author of the bestseller House of Cards, talking about what's happened in the year since everything hit the fan a year ago. And usually when you write a book like this and it's a success, You release a paperback version, new and updated, with a new introduction, maybe a new postscript or whatever. There's too much that's happened. You can't do that with this book, can you?
Well, I was just thinking to myself, you've been reading my email lately. The paperback version of the book will be released in January, I believe, and I've just finished an afterword, updating, not trying to go through all that's happened because that would be ridiculous, but explaining where some of the characters are now and some of the open questions that we're still left with as a result of all of this.
Well, one of the open questions for me is there were black holes of information as this crisis unfolded, like the size of the shadow banking system, the credit default swaps. Have mechanisms been put into place to make that information available now?
Not yet.
But we're talking about a year later after some pretty awful things have happened to our economy, the global economy.
The regulatory wheels move extremely slowly.
Well, in light of the size of the debacle, have you been surprised to see the banks push back against government attempts to increase oversight?
No, I haven't been surprised because that's their business, is to push back. They want as little regulation as possible. They know some is coming, so they're going to use their lobbyists to influence what we get.
But that's despite the fact that they have really, their image has been hurt.
Yes, I don't think they're quite as self-aware as we would like them to be. I think the typical person's reaction to what has happened is one of being appalled and shocked and in disbelief and wondering why there hasn't been more change. I think on Wall Street it's, hey, that really wasn't our fault. That was a collective failure. These things happen, and let's get back to business.
Even though they had pushed for all the deregulation that led to this problem and made an awful lot of money from what had ensued. What do you think the return of funds from the Toxic Asset Relief Program said about Wall Street's willingness to reform itself?
It said that it has no intention of doing that or desire to minimize it and a desire to get back to the status quo and business as usual as quickly as possible.
Well, the bailout seems to have worked to restore confidence in the markets, but it also did touch off an awful lot of public anger. In his speech on Monday, President Obama seemed to tap into this, and maybe we should take a listen.
The fact is, many of the firms that are now returning to prosperity owe a debt to the American people. They were not the cause of this crisis. And yet American taxpayers, through their government, had to take extraordinary action to stabilize the financial industry. They shouldered the burden of the bailout, and they are still bearing the burden of the fallout in lost jobs and lost homes and lost opportunities. It is neither right nor responsible, after you've recovered, with the help of your government, to shirk your obligation to the goal of wider recovery, a more stable system, and a more broadly shared prosperity.
How do you think that resonated on Wall Street?
I think that was a fine piece of speechwriting, by the way, and very well delivered. I think that the reaction in the room said it all. I mean, there was one round of applause, period. I don't think this resonates very well on Wall Street, as you can imagine.
In his speech, President Obama outlined his ideas for reform, and in the days since, the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Federal Reserve have made reform proposals. Why has it taken a year since the meltdown to come up with these proposals? I mean, Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner and Lawrence Summers, the director of the National Economic Council, did come up with a set of reform proposals back in June, and they're pretty much the same things that we're hearing now. That was months ago.
And believe it or not, even Paulson in March of 2008 put out a working paper about the way to change the system. I think the simple answer is Dow 9800. You know, if the Dow were still at 6500 as it was in March, not that long ago, you would see, huge impetus in Congress for change. But, people are forgetting and feeling a little bit better.
They're forgetting this quickly?
I mean, people who are losing their jobs and who can't pay their mortgages are not forgetting at all. And I'm sure they're letting people know in Congress. But, you know, Wall Street is, you know, very powerful lobby, and they've forgotten.
Well, Wall Street did pretty well in all those years when it was well-regulated.
Or they appeared to do well.
I mean, after World War II, there was a major boom, for example. The everything changed when some regulation was deregulated, Glass-Steagall, during the Clinton administration. Will these proposed reforms have a major impact on Wall Street?
Well, I think it's awfully tough to tell until we see what reforms actually get passed through the Congress. You know, there's this push now in the G20 to regulate banker pay and bonuses, and we'll see how that plays out in Pittsburgh, in a couple of weeks. But I think that until you fix the incentive system on Wall Street and the accountability system for people, you know, for people getting bonuses under what circumstances they can keep those bonuses, and make them accountable for their actions and the securities that they sell, I don't think you're going to stop another bubble. You can't regulate human behavior, unfortunately.
Well, the last time you were on the show, we talked about the government pressure surrounding the sale of Merrill Lynch to Bank of America. And earlier this week, a federal judge overturned a settlement between Bank of America and the SEC regarding the bonuses that were paid to Merrill Lynch executives just before the sale went through. Were you surprised by the forcefulness of Judge Jed Rakoff's statement?
Well, I think Judge Rakoff has always been outspoken, and I actually applaud him for not letting this little bit of jiu-jitsu go through. I also, though, think he is has missed a major point that, as I wrote about in my Atlantic piece that came out in September, about the failure of Ken Lewis, the CEO of Bank of America, to inform his shareholders about the huge losses at Merrill, forgetting the bonuses for a minute, the huge losses that he knew about in October and November before the shareholder vote on December 5th. He may have broken securities laws, and that is also something that needs to be looked into.
And he did that simply because he knew that the deal wouldn't go through otherwise.
That's right. I mean, if he let his shareholders know about the huge losses that Merrill was accumulating, they would have voted it down on December 5th.
New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo has issued subpoenas to members of the board of Bank of America. Do we know what kind of information he's hoping to get from them?
Well, I think he's trying to figure out, and while I have not seen the subpoenas, I think he's probably trying to figure out the decision-making process that occurred at the board level to decide whether or not to disclose information about the bonuses or to disclose information or not about the losses and to proceed with the shareholder vote. There was also the issue of invoking the material adverse change clause in the merger agreement and their decision not to do that under pressure from Paulson and Bernanke.
Can Cuomo pursue the aspect of Ken Lewis's non-disclosure of Merrill's problems, or is that something that can be done in New York State? Because Bank of America is not located here.
Well, they have businesses here. I'm not a lawyer, but I would suspect that, I mean, if you look at what, say, Dennis Kucinich, the representative from Ohio, is doing, he has written letters to the Mary Shapiro, the head of the SEC, to ask her and the SEC to investigate this. This is probably, since it's the SEC's regulations that Lewis probably violated, it's probably the SEC's purview to pursue this. And I'm told that Kucinich's office or the House committee that he's on that's looking into this has had discussions with the SEC about whether to pursue this further. And I suspect that they will.
My guest is William D. Cohn, who's book House of Cards was a bestseller when it was released. There'll be a new updated version released in paperback in January. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The Federal Reserve made a proposal yesterday that would give itself the power to reject compensation policies that it believes will encourage bankers to take on too much risk. Won't some banks try to argue that the Fed doesn't have the legal authority to do that?
I would suspect that the general counsels and their outside law firms of all these Wall Street firms will make whatever legal arguments they can to prevent this from happening.
But Congress approved the ability to restrict some pay as part of the bailout bill, didn't it?
Yes, but don't forget, a lot of these banks now are out of the TARP funds and therefore have paid it back and would argue that they're out of that kind of oversight, which is why I think they rushed to do it.
I hinted earlier about reports that we've been reading, especially in the New York Times, about Wall Street developing new financial instruments, including the securitization of life insurance policies. Are investors just looking for the next bubble?
Well, you know, my personal view is that, you know, whether Wall Street figures out a way to securitize life settlements or not, and they probably have, I think that is a non-issue, believe it or not. I don't think that's going to lead to another bubble. I think Wall Street is very good at...
Because it's so much smaller than housing?
Well, that in part, and because, believe it or not, Leonard, I think Wall Street is very good at not repeating its past mistakes. In other words, there was the crisis in junk bonds in the 80s and the crisis in internet IPOs in the late 90s and now the crisis in mortgage securitization in this decade. And there hasn't been a repetition of that, and I don't think that there will be, but there will be something else that we don't know yet. That's what I worry about.
Well, I guess if there was a feeling that real serious prosecutions could come out of this, then everybody would be a lot more careful. There have only been a handful relating to the financial crisis, the former Bear Stearns hedge fund managers, Ralph Chaffee and Matthew, what's his name?
Tanin.
That starts in mid-October. But Newsweek reports that their lawyers are confident they can show that the two of them were simply foolish, not criminal.
Right, and that's the very same argument they've made to me as well and that I reported on in my book and subsequent to that. And I've actually read many of the detailed emails, not just the selected portions that prosecutors picked out. And if you read through the full emails, you'll see that there was some ambiguity and that they were probably foolish and mistaken. And I'm not a grand jury or a jury, but it seems that it's going to be tough for them to prove, the prosecutors, that this was criminal intent.
So did they even understand what they were selling?
Oh, I mean, yes, I think they understood what they were selling, and I think the argument is that when they saw the market for mortgage-backed securities crack in the spring of 2007, that they saw that as a buying opportunity rather than a selling opportunity, which was a very big mistake. But whether that was criminal remains to be seen.
The Federal Trade Commission has just proposed the Securities and Exchange Commission has just proposed banning flash orders that give traders with super-fast computers the ability to take a split-second look at how the market is trending before making an order. How does that give an unfair advantage to some investors? And do you think that this is going to have any real impact?
Well, the flash traders, who've obviously spent a lot of money actually making these super-fast computers, getting these super-fast computers so they can do this kind of trading, are going to scream bloody murder, I'm sure. They argue that they provide liquidity to the market. But I do feel like it probably does give an unfair advantage to those who have, you know, access to that kind of trading vis-a-vis normal, you know, simple retail investors who are, you know, the losers in that.
So is this the first step of the SEC's reforms?
Well, maybe you could consider it the first step, but, you know, where are they? In my opinion, I haven't seen any action out of the SEC on, as we were talking about, on Ken Lewis and what he may or may not have done. Where's the SEC on the charges that there was a conspiracy in the trading that brought down Bear or Lehman in terms of who bought the short-term puts, the short-dated puts, and where's that? Where's all that information that we've been waiting for over a year now?
The Federal Trade Commission and a number of other government agencies announced yesterday that they'll be cracking down on mortgage rescue scams. Is that the stuff that I keep on getting telephone calls about? You have been selected to be helped. I get these recorded messages.
Well, one of the big aspects of the Obama regulatory overhaul is this consumer protection agency, if you will, to mirror the Environmental Protection Agency. And I think on balance, while that could be cumbersome and I'm not quite sure how it would work, I think the idea of it is a good one. Consumers do need to be protected from aggressive salespeople who make things that are not so great sound fabulous.
The SEC has pushed forward new rules for credit rating firms with an aim to reduce conflicts of interest and to create more competition among them. Will that help create a more realistic picture of what's going on in the market?
I think there's a serious need for overhaul among the rating agencies, and I'm glad to see the SEC is taking some steps which I hope go far enough to change all of that, because the rating agencies have been seriously discredited as a result of their actions in this crisis.
Well, they were rubber stamping what they were, whatever they were asked to give a rating to, they gave.
And they were paid by the underwriters, the Wall Street firms that were asking for the rating. And so they said, okay, what rating do you want? We'll give it to you, and thank you very much for our fee.
Now, this story is going to continue, and I suspect there'll be all sorts of odd wrinkles along the way. Will you promise me now that you'll come back to talk about them?
Absolutely. It's my pleasure, Leonard.
William D. Cohn is the author of the bestseller House of Cards. It's been my great pleasure to talk to him today on the one-year anniversary of the week when I keep on wanting to say when everything hit the fan, but I'm not sure that's the right way to describe it.
Well, when American capitalism almost went down the tubes is another way to think about it.
And it had a global impact that we're still feeling.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you.